preaching can be dangerous. When you're just sitting around with a group of your friends shooting the breeze and you say something stupid, they don't really care because they already know you say stupid things. So they just tell you what you just said was stupid and the conversation moves on, no harm, no foul. But when you're preaching to an entire congregation in the sanctuary and online, and you say something stupid, it can do a lot more damage. So this past week, I was thinking to myself, what's the stupidest thing I've ever said in a sermon? Some of you may have some thoughts about that. But the instance that came to my mind, and some of you have been around here long enough to remember, was back in 2005. It wasn't a sermon per se, but a sermon-like setting. It was at the annual fundraising dinner for the Lambda Legal Defense Fund in at the downtown Sheraton Ballroom, a room full of 1,000 people, a sort of a swanky event to raise funds for Lambda, which is a national organization that litigates on behalf of civil rights for LGBTQ plus people. And so they asked me if I would give the opening prayer for that event. And I was delighted to do that because as a former lawyer, I figured, okay, I know how to pray for lawyers. And also this would give a chance in a group of about 1,000 people to raise the profile of the church. Surely there were folks there who would be interested in a church like ours. So when the moment comes, they introduce me and I step up to the podium and I start to pray and it's going swimmingly well. I mean, I'm on a roll. I'm praying, God, I pray that you will bless the Lambda Legal Defense Fund lawyers as they decide what cases to take and not to take. I pray that you will bless them as they figure out their legal strategies in their case. I pray that you will bless them as they make their arguments in front of the judges. And God, I said, I pray that you will bless their briefs. And as soon as I said that, it was like, oh, what did I just say? Because as a former lawyer, when I say briefs, the first things that come to mind is legal filings. But for most of the 1,000 non-lawyers in that audience, when they hear briefs, they think of underwear. So here's the preacher asking God to bless the underwear of the Lambda Legal Defense lawyers. I heard a few quiet snickers, but hoped that most people hadn't noticed. But as soon as I said amen and started back to my table, there was this uproar of conversation in the room as people leaned over to the person next to them saying, did you hear what that preacher said? And the laughter all over the room. And I felt like such a fool. Here I wanted to make a positive impression. Everybody was thinking, wow, he's a piece of work. I was thinking about the stupidest thing I ever said in the sermon this past week. Because after last Sunday's sermon, someone who's new to our congregation walked up to me afterward and said, hey, can I take a moment to talk to you about your sermon? I said, sure. What's on your mind? He said, well, you know, there was this and that and the other that I got from your sermon that was good for me. But he said, there's something that made me uncomfortable. I said, what was that? He said, what you said about Elon Musk. As you'll recall in last Sunday's sermon, there was a point where I mentioned that Elon Musk, through his leadership of Doge, defunded USAID, and that as a result of that, over the past year, it's estimated that 750,000 of the poorest poor in the world have died of hunger or treatable diseases, 500,000 of them children. I also mentioned how Musk himself has told people that he is not happy most of the time and doesn't have peace, and I talked about his ketamine use and just how he struggles, the richest man in the world, but struggles in his life. And so this person said to me, it made me uncomfortable. My paraphrase is that he felt like I was piling on Elon Musk. He said, I'm no big fan of Elon Musk, but he raised several thoughtful counterpoints, such as when there was the flooding in North Carolina, Musk allowed his Starlink system to be used to save many lives. And he mentioned how Musk's ketamine use may be more than recreational. It may be an addiction, a form of illness. He mentioned that that Musk has said that he's on the autism spectrum, and that may affect how Musk interacts with the world and how he's perceived in the world. Very thoughtful points. So I thanked him for that feedback, and I assured him that here at Life Journey Church, it is an honorable thing to disagree with what the pastor says, because we want this to be a place, a learning environment, a place of robust conversation. The New Testament says, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. We want this to be that kind of a place. So I thanked him for his feedback, and I told him that his feedback was really timely, because as fate would have it, as we continue in our sermon series about how to build beautiful relationships the Jesus way, as fate would have it, today, this Sunday, we are slated to talk about how judgmentalism can damage our relationships. And so I said to him, what you have said to me gives me a lot of food for thought as I prepare for next Sunday, because what this new person had said to me raised in my mind the question of, what is the line between being judgmental, a bad thing, and offering honest feedback and critique, a good thing? In fact, in a sermon just a few weeks ago, we talked about how being able to give and receive honest feedback in relationship is absolutely critical. So what's the line between the two? Didn't Jesus himself sometimes judge people? You could even argue that the critique this new person was sharing with me about my sermon was a form of judgment, not a bad form, but a form of judgment. So when Jesus says to us, judge not that you be not judged, what did he mean? Let's wrestle with that today, and how judgmentalism, rightly understood, can damage our relationships. Jesus, we want to understand better. We need to understand better so that we can live more fully into the brilliance and wisdom of your teachings, and in the process, grow stronger, healthier, more beautiful relationships. So please guide our thoughts today. We ask in your holy name. Amen. So, Jesus said, Matthew 7:1, judge not that you may not be judged. For with the judgment you make, you will be judged. And the measure you give will be the measure you get back. The rest of the New Testament picks up on this theme and echoes the theme throughout. For example, Romans 14:10, why do you pass judgment on your brother or sister? Or why do you despise your brother or sister? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. Each of us individually will be accountable to God. Let us therefore no longer pass judgment on one another. James 4:11, do not speak evil against one another or judge another. Who are you to judge your neighbor? So clearly, one of the core teachings of Jesus and the New Testament is that we who follow Jesus should not be judgmental people. Okay, Jesus, but what does that mean? Don't just tell me not to judge. Show me in a way I can understand what that means. You know what they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. So I, for example, could try to describe for you how beautiful my cat Gigi is, or I could just show you a picture of her. Isn't she a beautiful little baby? I could try to describe for you how wild and crazy my dog Oreo's personality is, or I could just show you a picture that captures the essence of that personality. Here's Oreo. We're supposed to be on a walk on a long leash. She decides she's going to roll in the grass instead, get all tangled up in her leash. Right before this, she ran through our neighbor's sprinkler, like a kid would run through a sprinkler, ran right up to the sprinkler head and stuck her big mouth over it, getting a spray of water in her mouth. a crazy, a wild, out of control dog. That's Oreo. I could try to describe for you my all-time favorite work of art, Salvador Dali's epic painting of the Last Supper that hangs in the National Museum of Art in Washington, D.C. I could try and try and try with a lot of words to describe it to you, but better to simply show it to you. Ah, the radiance of Jesus, the transcendence of Jesus contrasted with the despair of his disciples at the Last Supper. The difference between how God sometimes sees the world versus how we see the world. Love this painting. A small replica of it hangs in my office here at the church. And now that you have seen it, you get it. You understand it. So Jesus, don't just tell me not to judge. Show me what that means. Give me a picture. And that's exactly what Jesus, the master teacher, does in today's gospel lesson. He tells us a story that paints for us a vivid word picture of what he meant when he said, judge not. You heard the passage read right before the sermon. At the beginning of the story, Jesus tells us, Luke 18:10, two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee steps out into the middle of the temple courtyard, surrounded by hundreds of people there in the outer courtyard. The Pharisee looks around him and sees all of these people. And then the Pharisee lifts his eyes to heaven and begins to pray thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people. Thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like that tax collector over there. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income, etc., etc. Then Jesus tells us, the tax collector, standing far off, not even wanting to be seen, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Then Jesus adds these words, I tell you, this second man, the tax collector, went down to his home justified rather than the other, the Pharisee. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted. And there you have it. From Jesus, a vivid word picture of what he meant when he said, don't be judgmental. What we see here in this story, it seems to me, is that judgmentalism is less about actions and more about attitude. By which I mean the action of critiquing someone else or ourselves is not in and of itself a bad thing. It can even be a good thing. Honest feedback. So judgmentalism, as Jesus portrays it to us, is not so much about the action of critiquing someone, but rather the attitude with which we do that critiquing. And so in our story, as Jesus portrays the Pharisee looks around him and says, I thank you that I'm not like other people. It's as if the Pharisee is putting himself on a pedestal, elevating him above the people around him and looking down on them from a position of moral superiority. By the way, I kind of like the view from up here. Me! A paragon of virtue, standing high above you, looking down on you, wagging my finger at you, and telling you what's wrong with you. It makes me feel good about myself. That's the spirit, the posture, the perspective from which the Pharisee was evaluating, critiquing the people around him, when in reality, his posture should have been that of the tax collector on his knees, head bowed, with a spirit and attitude that says, we're all sinners. We're all in this together. God, even as I evaluate and encourage and critique those around me, help me to do the same of myself. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. So the judgmentalism is about posture and perspective. Your posture and your perspective, Jesus says, determines whether what you are doing should be condemned as judgmentalism. Whether we're judging ourselves or the people around us. I should say, whether we're critiquing ourselves or the people around us. It should be done with a spirit of humility that says we're all in this together. It should be done with a keen awareness of my own profound shortcomings. So, judgmentalism, as defined by Jesus, can be explained this way. Judgmentalism is when I judge people with an attitude of moral superiority that leads to harsh criticism rather than compassionate evaluation. There's a big difference between harsh criticism, judgmentalism, and compassionate evaluation, which we're all called upon to offer, whether you're a teacher, a parent, an employer, just a good friend, a spouse. We all have a responsibility, if we love the people around us, to share honest feedback and to receive honest feedback. That's not the sin. The sin is when we do that with an attitude of contempt and condescension, an elevated attitude of ourselves toward the people around us. So, what was so stupid about what I said about Elon Musk last Sunday, I believe, as I reflect on it, was not the content of what I said about him. The things I said about him were true things, objectively true things, some things he himself acknowledges. That wasn't the problem. The problem was my posture. The problem was I was up here and implicitly inviting all of us to be up here and say, in effect, thank God we're not like guys like that. When in reality, I should have been inviting us, even as we reflect on him and learn from his, in this case, adverse example, we should have been down here with a spirit of, not of contempt, but of sadness and of self-awareness. That we're all in this together. And we can learn from his shortcomings, and he can learn from our shortcomings. That's the spirit that we're called to. But the truth is, it's easy. It's easy for any of us to fall into that trap of judgmentalism. It comes so natural to us. Late one night in New York City, an old drunk boarded a bus. He stumbled down the aisle on the bus and plopped down in a seat next to a woman who just got off the late shift. This woman, prim and proper, was sitting there and had her Bible open in her lap, was reading the Bible. She saw the drunk staggering down the aisle, plopped down next to her, smelled the alcohol in his breath. She took one look at him, glared at him over her horn-rimmed glasses, and said to him, I've got news for you, mister. You're going straight to hell. Stunned, he stood up and said, oh, man, don't tell me I got on the wrong bus again. Poor guy, just wanted to get to the Bronx, but he got on the bus to hell. What Jesus is trying to tell us in today's gospel story is, don't be like that woman on the bus. Don't be like the Pharisee in Jesus' story. In his book, The Gospel According to Jesus, Chris Say tells how when how he grew up in a family that stretched to make ends meet. He and his father happened to love the Houston Astros and loved to go to the Astros games when they could, but they could only afford tickets in the outfield bleacher section, the cheap seats. So Chris says inevitably at these games, he and his father, would be surrounded by all these other people who, most of whom had purchased the cheap seats, not because they couldn't afford better seats, but because they wanted to save the rest of their money for beer. So he says by the third inning, everybody around them would be three sheets to the wind. And by the seventh inning, he says, it was a crazy place. People would be spilling beer down your back. There'd be a brawl breaking out a couple rows behind them. The ground would be covered with spilt beer and peanut shells. And he says, out there in the outfield bleachers, the most notorious guy was somebody named Batty Bob. Batty Bob was the self-appointed mascot of the Houston Astros, who came to every game sitting out there in the bleachers wearing this lavish rainbow wig. And once Batty Bob had a few beers under his belt and loosened up a little bit, he would slurringly lead cheers against the opposing team in favor of the Astros, leading cheers for all the people in the bleachers. Chris says, at the church that we attended at the time, I had absorbed from the culture of the church that we were going to, that these people around us on the bleachers at the Astros games, these were those people. Bad people. So Chris says, I was really surprised at one game when my father sat down on the bleacher next to Batty Bob and engaged him in a conversation. One of those people. In fact, he says, my dad and Batty Bob made conversation through the entire game. And at the end of the game, he says, Dad invited Batty Bob to come back to our house. Chris, in his own words, describes the rest of what happened. He says, I was more than confused because this guy, Batty Bob, was supposed to be one of the bad people. But when we got home, my dad came into my room and explained to me how much God loved Batty Bob. I remember thinking, really, Batty Bob? Batty Bob stayed with us for a few days to get back on his feet. This is when I started to realize that God did not despise those people. God dearly loves them. You see, it's not us versus them. It's not the good people versus the bad people. We are all in this together, and we all have our own stuff that we need to deal with. So, when Jesus says, don't be judgmental, he means, don't cop an attitude of moral superiority that allows you to look down on the people around you with contempt and harshly criticize them, as opposed to compassionately evaluating. Okay, Jesus, I think we've got it. But it's one thing to know what we're supposed to do, and another thing to have the internal capacity to do it. I know I'm not supposed to be judgmental, but how do I cooperate with God in the process of transforming from a harsh critic into a compassionate evaluator? This past week, as I pondered that, as I thought about that, it occurred to me that there are three great biblical truths which, if internalized, I believe help us to become instinctively a compassionate evaluator instead of a harsh judger. So in the time we have left, let's quickly look at those three great biblical truths that, if internalized, can help us to live into what Jesus is teaching us today. How can I transform from a harsh judge into a compassionate evaluator, step number one, get in touch with my own profound shortcomings. Remember how our gospel passage began today. It began telling us that Jesus was going to tell us a story to warn us not to be the kind of people who trust in themselves that they are righteous and regard others with contempt. If I am viewing myself as one of the good people, I'm already in trouble, right? Because I'm just one of the people with my fair share of profound shortcomings. Remember, Jesus ends our gospel passage today by saying, all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted. Jesus is saying we need to come at life and we need to come at our critique of the people around us from a position of humility. But that's not easy. It's not easy because, well, it's easy for me to see what's wrong with you. It's easy for me to see your sins. I could tell you all about it. But it's hard for me to see and acknowledge my own sins, my own shortcomings. A husband was worried that his wife was losing her hearing. He decided to conduct a little informal home test. And so she was standing at the kitchen counter late one afternoon. He positions himself about 20 feet behind her and says, "Honey, what's for dinner tonight?" He hears no response. So he walks within 10 feet behind her and repeats himself, "Honey, what's for dinner tonight?" No response. He gets right up behind her. "Honey, what's for dinner tonight?" She turns around and says to him, "George, for the third time, beef stew." She's not the one who needed hearing aids. He's the one. And that's you and me. It's easy for us to spot and diagnose the people around us. It's painful. It's hard to see and acknowledge our own sins and shortcomings. As I mentioned earlier, what was stupid about what I said about Elon Musk? It was not so much the content of what he said, but the position from which I was saying it. It's as if I was up on a pedestal, inviting you to get up on a pedestal and to look down on him as if, thank God, we're not one of those kind of people. God, I'm so grateful that I'm not a thief, a rogue, an adulterer, and Elon Musk. I'm so grateful. That was the stupid thing about what I said. Or I should say, how I said it. I believe what was said was worthy and important. The part about how the decisions that Musk led have caused more than 750,000 of the poorest of the poor to perish of hunger or treatable diseases over the past year. I mean, we are citizens in a democracy. We have a responsibility for critiquing our political and public figures. We have a responsibility for speaking out. The scriptures themselves say, defend the weak and the fatherless. Uphold the cause of the poor. The scriptures say, speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. Defend the rights of the poor. So we, along with Bill Gates, can look at someone like Elon Musk and critique him for being the world's richest man, killing the poorest children in the world. That's valid, but in what spirit do we do that? Thank God I would never be like him. Because the truth is, this past week, as I was pondering all of this, it hit me like a ton of bricks that the very thing I was looking down on him with contempt for, that very sin, I myself participate in. What he has done on an industrial scale, if I'm going to be honest, I do on a smaller scale in my personal life. He says America first. I say me first. what I mean by that, and I know I'm plowing deep today, but hang with me. This is important. What I mean by all of that, let me explain. For a number of years now, for a couple decades now, our church has had a partnership with the Child Fund International, whereby a number of our congregants contribute an extra $24 a month, and we bundle all that money, and then we send it off each month to Child Fund International to support 20-plus children across the globe who are among the poorest of the poor, to help them with food and medicine and those kinds of things. We launched that program, golly, 25 years ago probably, and have helped raise a couple generations of 20-plus of the poorest of the poor children in the world. A wonderful thing. Over time, when we first began that program, I was participating in that program, giving an extra $24 a month. Then my child aged out of the system, and I didn't renew. But this past week, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I should be doing that. I mean, you can't do everything, right? I am generous with the church and God's work in the world. But it occurred to me that at a time like this, when so much of the aid our nation collectively has been giving to the world is gone, at a time like this, I need to step up my game. I need to get reintegrated into that extra $24 a month. Who am I to get up on my pedestal and critique Elon Musk if I myself am not stretching and doing a little extra? I can do an extra $24 a month and it won't affect my life. I have to look back and say, if I'm going to be honest, there may well be some child in the world who died because of my neglect, my oversight. So that instead of being up here critiquing Musk, I should be down here saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I decided this past week I need to get re-involved with that program. By the way, if any of you want to, let me know and I'll put you in touch with our global outreach board. You can get the information you need. But a vivid example of what Jesus meant when he said, physician, heal yourself. If I want to compassionately offer feedback and critique of the people around me, to do it in the right way, I first have to get in touch with my own profound shortcomings. Step number one toward transitioning from harsh judge to someone who is a compassionate evaluator. Step number two is to recognize that we are all products of forces far more powerful than us. Therefore, there is a reason why the person I'm tempted to judge is the way they are. In your life right now, who is the person that you are most tempted to judge? I'm here to tell you today, they are the way they are for a reason. And it helps when we see it that way. They are the way they are for a reason. And I can say that because that's what the Bible says to us. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, when the Apostle Paul is critiquing the Corinthian Christians, some of the Corinthian Christians were being judgmental of the Corinthian Christians. Some of them were considering themselves better than, more righteous than, and looking down on others that were in that congregation. And when Paul is talking to those who have elevated themselves above the others, this is what he says to them. 1 Corinthians 4:7. What do you have that you did not receive? And if you received it, why do you boast as if it were not a gift? Do you see the significance of that? Do you see what that's saying? Paul is saying to those people who consider themselves better than, he's saying to them, those strengths that you're so proud of having and that you look down on other people for not having, he says, why are you so proud of that? You didn't do anything to earn it. Those things, those strengths you've got were gifts that were given to you. In other words, the product of nurture, nature, and circumstance. Name any strength that you might have, and I guarantee you, we can trace it back. It's not like you earned it. I worked hard for that. Well, where did you get that spirit to work hard? Through nurture, nature, or circumstance. Everything we are that's good, we have received. But that also means that every weakness that we have received. By which I mean, it's a product of nurture, nature, or circumstance. Now, that doesn't excuse it. That doesn't mean I say, oh, well, that's just the way I am. We still work on it, but when we realize that the weaknesses that we see in the people around us, it's not like they woke up one day and said, I'm going to be a bad person. It's not like they woke up one day and said, I'm going to be an annoying person. No. They got that way because forces more powerful than them, nurture, nature, circumstances, shaped them that way. Now, we can compassionately offer them feedback and encourage them, but to harshly judge them is unfair because they received it. They didn't make themselves that way. For example, one of my strengths is I'm a decent public speaker, and I could be proud of that. But why? I just received that. It's not something I earned. When I was a little kid, I would fall asleep at night listening to the cassette tapes of sermons given by great preachers. Not just because I wanted to hear the content, but somehow the way I was put together, nurture nature, I was fascinated by the methodology. How were they making the case that was so persuasive? And when I was in high school and decided to take a public speaking course to see if I could become a better public speaker, and when I was feeling like I was crashing and burning in that class, I just happened to overhear a whispered conversation between two of my classmates saying that they thought I was a good public speaker. I wasn't even supposed to overhear that conversation, but I overheard it. It was like, oh, and it gave me the confidence to press forward instead of giving up on that class. I received that. I didn't earn it. It was given. So why would I be proud about that? Another one of my strengths is telling drop-dead funny jokes. I can't explain it. It's just a gift. I was walking down the hall at church in the office area this past week, and I heard the strangest thing. I heard what sounded like music coming from the printer in our copy room. And I thought, am I hearing things? Am I imagining things? Am I losing my mind? So I walked into the copy room, and it wasn't the printer. It was the paper jamming. It's just a gift. Or maybe I need a little honest feedback. You can talk to me after this service. For real, one of my great weaknesses, if I'm going to be honest, probably my greatest sin, is workaholism. Hard work is a strength, but any strength taken to an extreme and out of balance becomes a weakness. And if I'm going to be honest, my workaholism is harmful to me and to my loved ones. But it's not like I woke up one day and said, I'm going to be a workaholic. You know how I got to be that way? I'll tell you. My father! It's his fault! He talked about somebody who worked really hard. He was a realtor, worked for RE/MAX, selling luxury homes in the Colorado Mountains, set global records because he worked really hard. And I don't know how he got it, nurture, nature, but I got it too. It was given to me. That doesn't excuse it. I need to work on it. I am working on it. Doing a little bit better. But if it's so hard for me to break workaholism, that sure gives me a whole lot more sympathy and empathy for others who struggle to change themselves, people who have addictions even more embracing than that one. It makes it a lot easier for me to have empathy for them, because We are how we are for a reason. And when we get in touch with that, it's hard to be a harsh judge of that other person. True story. Picture a 12-year-old boy lying on the floor at the foot of a long staircase in his school. He's at the bottom of the stairs, on the floor, covered with blood and bruises. Because a group of bullies at the top of the steps had pushed him with all their might, and he went tumbling down those steps, landing at the bottom, covered in blood and bruises. And now the bullies were hovering over him and kicking him, kicking the stuff out of him with all their might until he lost consciousness. He wakes up in the emergency room, facing a long recovery. You see, that kid, that 12-year-old boy, was a classic know-it-all nerd, socially awkward, slight of build, the perfect target for the bullies in his school. And those bullies bullied him relentlessly. And then that boy would come home at night to an abusive father who repeatedly told him, "You're a loser. You'll never amount to anything. You will never be successful in this world." That boy, now a man, looks back on his childhood and uses one word to describe his childhood. It's misery. Now, do you think that abuse that that boy, now a man, experienced has left profound wounds and created maladaptations and some dysfunctions that he might carry with him to this day? Of course. Do you know who I'm talking about? Elon Musk. After that conversation with that congregant last Sunday, I said, you know, before I judge him, maybe I should take the time to understand him and how he got to be how he is. What forces made him the way he is? So I started reading about him, and I was cut to the heart and found myself climbing down off my pedestal and getting down on my knees and saying, God help him. He doesn't need my judgment. He needs my encouragement. He needs my honest feedback, your honest feedback, the honest feedback of people's life, but he doesn't need condemnation. He doesn't need us to heap on the abuse. Loser, you'll never be anything. To paraphrase what Chris Say said, this is when I started to realize that God does not despise Elon Musk. God dearly loves him. How do we transition from harsh judges to empathetic, compassionate evaluators? Step one, get in touch with my own profound shortcomings. Step two, recognize that we're all products of forces more powerful than us. The person I'm judging is the way they are for a reason. And that finally then leads me to the third. That causes me then to want to show grace to the person that I'm tempted to judge instead of showing them contempt. Grace is the single most powerful healing force in the cosmos. The Bible tells us you have been saved by grace. That means grace is the greatest good in the cosmos. That means when I show someone grace, I am engaged in the greatest act of goodness that is possible for a human being. But by contrast, that also means when I do the opposite of grace, harsh judgmentalism, I am committing the greatest sin a human can commit. It turns out that when that Pharisee was standing in the temple court and looking at the hundreds of people who were around him in that temple court, the thieves, the rogues, the adulterers, the tax collectors. It turns out that the greatest sinner among them was that religious Pharisee who was committing the greatest sin of all. Harsh judgmentalism, the opposite of the greatest goodness, grace. Do you want to help the person you are judging get better? Share some grace with them. I'll close with this. Back in 2019, comedian Pat Oswalt published a tweet that was caustically critical of President Trump. Meanwhile, a prominent online defender of Trump, a guy named Michael Beatty, seeing Oswald's tweet, Beatty responded to Oswald with an equally caustic tweet about Oswald, which then, of course, caused Oswald to put a caustic tweet up about Beatty. Happens all the time on social media, right? Tit for tat, back and forth. Meanwhile, Oswald thinks to himself, I wonder who this Beatty guy is, and starts scrolling through Beatty's timeline. As he does so, Oswald says, I was cut to the heart because of what he saw in Beatty's timeline. And that caused Oswald to put up another tweet to his, Oswald's, followers that read as follows. Aw, man, this dude that just attacked me on Twitter, Michael Beatty, this dude that just attacked me on Twitter, and I joked back, but then I looked at his timeline, and he's in a lot of trouble health-wise. He's been dealt some terrible cards. So let's deal him some good ones. Click and donate, like I'm about to, and then Oswald posted a link to a GoFundMe page that Michael Beatty had created because Beatty suffers from severe diabetes and complications of ketoacidosis and had accumulated an enormous amount for him of medical bills that he couldn't pay, and he was facing potential bankruptcy and struggling to keep up with what he needed medically. And so Oswald asked his followers to go to this link, this GoFundMe page of Beatty, and within 24 hours, the $5,000 goal that Beatty had set for his GoFundMe page was tripled, which then caused Beatty to put up this tweet to Oswald. You have humbled me to the point where I can barely compose my words. You have caused me to take pause and reflect on how harmful words from my mouth could result in such an outpouring of grace. And with that, Michael Beatty became a little bit better person. And Pat Oswalt became a little bit better person. And this world became a little bit better place. Thomas Merton sums it up this way. Don't be too quick to assume that your enemy is a savage just because he's your enemy. Perhaps he's your enemy because he thinks you are a savage. Or perhaps he's afraid of you because he feels you are afraid of him. And perhaps if he believed you were capable of loving him, he would no longer be your enemy. This is how we, as followers of Jesus, are supposed to build more beautiful relationships. Thank you, Jesus, for showing us the way, the truth, and the life. Now give us the strength to go out of here and live it. Amen.